the most ferociously trained and lavishly equipped army in the world, and one sworn to uphold the power of the Magisterium. Lee had intended to rest a night before setting off, because Grumman looked in need of it, but there was no chance of finding a room.
"What's going on?"
he said to the boatman when he returned the hired boat.
"We don't know. The regiment arrived yesterday and commandeered every billet, every scrap of food, and every ship in the town. They'd have had this boat, too, if you hadn't taken it."
"Do you know where they're going?"
"North. There's a war going to be fought, by all accounts. The greatest war ever known."
"North? Into that new world?"
"That's right. And there's more troops coming. This is just the advance guard. There won't be a loaf of bread or a gallon of spirit left in a week's time. You did me a favor taking this boat. The price has already doubled."
There was no sense in resting up now, even if they could find a place. Full of anxiety about his balloon, Lee went at once to the warehouse where he'd left it, with Grumman beside him. The man was keeping pace. He looked sick, but he was tough. The warehousekeeper, busy counting out some spare engine parts to a requisitioning sergeant of the guard, looked up briefly from his clipboard.
"Balloon? Too bad. Requisitioned yesterday. You can see how it is. I've got no choice."
Hester flicked her ears, and Lee understood what she meant.
"Have you delivered the balloon yet?"
"They're going to collect it this afternoon."
"No, they're not. Because I have an authority that trumps the guard."
And he showed the warehouseman the ring he'd taken from the finger of the dead Skraeling on Nova Zembla. The sergeant beside him at the counter stopped what he was doing and saluted at the sight of the church's token. But for all his discipline, he couldn't prevent a flicker of puzzlement passing over his face.
"So, we'll have the balloon right now. And you can set some men to fill it. And I mean at once. That includes food and water and ballast."
The warehouseman looked at the sergeant, who shrugged and then hurried away to see to the balloon. Lee and Grumman withdrew to the wharf, where the gas tanks were, to supervise the filling and talk quietly.
"Where did you get that ring?"
"Off a dead man's finger. Kind of risky using it, but I couldn't see another way of getting my balloon back. You reckon that sergeant suspected anything?"
"Of course he did. But he's a disciplined man. He won't question the church. If he reports it at all, we'll be away by the time they can do anything about it. Well, I promised you a wind, Mr. Scoresby. I hope you like it."
The sky was blue overhead now, and the sunlight was bright. To the north, the fog bank still hung like a mountain range over the sea, but the breeze was pushing them back and back, and Lee was impatient for the air again. As the balloon filled and began to swell up beyond the edge of the warehouse roof, Lee checked the basket and stowed all his equipment with particular care. For in the other world, who knew what turbulence they'd meet? His instruments, too, he fixed to the framework with close attention, even the compass, whose needle was swinging around the dial quite uselessly. Finally, he lashed a score of sandbags around the basket for ballast. When the gas bag was full and leaning northward in the buffeting breeze, and the whole apparatus straining against the stout ropes anchoring it down, Lee paid the warehouseman with the last of his gold and helped Grumman into the basket. Then he turned to the men at the ropes to give the order to let go. But before they could do so, there was an interruption. From the alley at the side of the warehouse came the noise of pounding boots moving at the double and a shout of command.
"Halt!"
The men at the ropes paused, some looking that way, some looking to Lee, and he called sharply,
"Let go! Cast off!"
Two of the men obeyed, and the balloon lurched up, but the other two had their attention on the soldiers, who were moving quickly around the corner of the building. Those two men still held their ropes fast around the bollards, and the balloon lurched sickeningly sideways. Lee grabbed at the suspension ring. Grumman was holding it too, and his demon had her claws tight around it.
"Let go, you damn fools! She's going up!"
The buoyancy of the gas bag was too great, and the men, haul as they might, couldn't hold it back. One let go, and his rope lashed itself loose from the bollard. But the other man, feeling the rope lift, instinctively clung on instead of letting go. Lee had seen this happen once before, and dreaded it. The poor man's demon, a heavy-set husky, howled with fear and pain from the ground as the balloon surged up towards the sky, and 5 endless seconds later it was over. The man's strength failed. He fell half-dead and crashed into the water. But the soldiers had their rifles up already. A volley of bullets whistled past the basket, one striking a spark from the suspension ring and making Lee's hands sting with the impact, but none of them did any damage. By the time they fired their second shot, the balloon was almost out of range, hurtling up into the blue and speeding out over the sea. Lee felt his heart lift with it. He'd said once to Serafina Pekala that he didn't care for flying, that it was only a job. But he hadn't meant it. Soaring upward with a fair wind behind and a new world in front, what could be better in this life? He let go of the suspension ring and saw that Hester was crouching in her usual corner, eyes half closed. From far below and a long way back came another futile volley of rifle fire. The town was receding fast, and the broad sweep of the river's mouth was glittering in the sunlight below them.
Well, Dr. Grumman, I don't know about you, but I feel better in the air. I wish that poor man had let go of the rope, though. It's so damned easy to do, and if you don't let go at once, there's no hope for you.
Thank you, Mr. Scoresby. You managed that very well. Now we settle down and fly. I would be grateful for those furs. The air is still cold.
Chapter 11. The Belvedere. In the great white villa in the park, Will slept uneasily, plagued with dreams that were filled with anxiety and with sweetness in equal measure, so that he struggled to wake up and yet longed for sleep again. When his eyes were fully open, he felt so drowsy that he could scarcely move, and then he sat up to find his bandage loose and his bed crimson. He struggled out of bed and made his way through the heavy, dust-filled sunlight and silence of the great house down to the kitchen. He and Lyra had slept in servants' rooms under the attic, not feeling welcomed by the stately four-poster beds in the grand rooms further down, and it was a long, unsteady walk.
"Will,"
she said at once, her voice full of concern, and she turned from the stove to help him to a chair. He felt dizzy. He supposed he'd lost a lot of blood. Well, there was no need to suppose, with the evidence all over him. And the wounds were still bleeding.
"I was just making some coffee. Do you want that first, or shall I do another bandage? I can do whichever you want, and there's eggs in the cold cabinet, but I can't find any baked beans."
"This isn't a baked beans kind of house. Bandage first. Is there any hot water in the tap I want to wash? Ugh, I hate being covered in this."
She ran some hot water and he stripped to his underpants. He was too faint and dizzy to feel embarrassed, but Lyra became embarrassed for him and went out. He washed as best he could and then dried himself on the tea towels that hung on a line by the stove. When she came back, she'd found some clothes for him, just a shirt and canvas trousers and a belt. He put them on and she tore a fresh tea towel into strips and bandaged him tightly again. She was badly worried about his hand. Not only were the wounds bleeding freely still, but the rest of the hand was swollen and red. But he said nothing about it, and neither did she. Then she made the coffee and toasted some stale bread, and they took it into the grand room at the front of the house, overlooking the city. When he'd eaten and drunk, he felt a little better.
"You better ask the alethiometer what to do next. Have you asked her anything yet?"
"No, I'm only going to do what you ask from now on. I thought of doing it last night, but I never did. And I won't either, unless you ask me to."
"Well, you better do it now. There's as much danger here as there is in my world now. There's Angelica's brother for a start, and if..."
He stopped because she began to say something, but she stopped as soon as he did. Then she collected herself and went on.
"Will, there was something that happened yesterday that I didn't tell you. I should have, but there was just so many other things going on. I'm sorry."
And she told him everything she'd seen through the window of the tower while Giacomo Paradisi was dressing Will's wound. Tullio being beset by the spectres, Angelica seeing her at the window and her look of hatred, and Paolo's threat.
"And you remember when she first spoke to us? Her little brother said something about what they were all doing. He said, 'He's going to get...' And she wouldn't let him finish. She smacked him, remember? I bet he was going to say Tullio was after the knife, and that's why all the kids came here. Because if they had the knife, they could do anything. They could even grow up without being afraid of spectres."
"What did it look like when he was attacked?"
To her surprise, he was sitting forward, his eyes demanding and urgent.
"He..."
She tried to remember exactly.
"He started counting the stones in the wall. He sort of felt all over them, but he couldn't keep it up. In the end, he sort of lost interest and stopped. Then he was just still."
She finished, and seeing Will's expression, she said,
Why?
Because I think maybe they come from my world after all, the Spectres. If they make people behave like that, I wouldn't be surprised at all if they came from my world. And when the Guildmen opened their first window, if it was into my world, the Spectres could have gone through then.
But you don't have Spectres in your world. You never heard of them, did you?
Maybe they're not called Spectres. Maybe we call them something else.
Lyra wasn't sure what he meant, but she didn't want to press him. His cheeks were red and his eyes were hot.
Anyway,
she went on, turning away.
The important thing is that Angelica saw me in the window. And now that she knows we've got the knife, she'll tell all of them. She'll think it's our fault that her brother was attacked by Spectres. I'm sorry, Will. I should have told you earlier, but there was just so many other things.
Well, I don't suppose it would have made any difference. He was torturing the old man. And once he knew how to use the knife, he'd have killed both of us if he could. We had to fight him.
I just feel bad about it, Will. I mean, he was their brother. And I bet if we were them, we'd have wanted the knife too.
Yes, but we can't go back and change what happened. We had to get the knife to get the alethiometer back. And if we could have got it without fighting, we would.
Yeah, we would.
Like Yorick Birnison, Will was a fighter truly enough. So she was prepared to agree with him when he said it would be better not to fight. She knew it wasn't cowardice that spoke, but strategy. He was calmer now and his cheeks were pale again. He was looking into the middle distance and thinking.
It's probably more important now to think about Sir Charles and what he'll do, or Mrs. Coulter. Maybe if she's got this special bodyguard they were talking about, these soldiers who had their demons cut away, maybe Sir Charles is right and they'll be able to ignore the Spectres. You know what I think? I think what they eat, the Spectres, is people's demons.
But children have demons too, and they don't attack children. It can't be that.
Then it must be the difference between children's demons and grown-ups. There is a difference, isn't there? You told me once that grown-ups' demons don't change shape. It must be something to do with that. And if these soldiers of hers haven't got demons at all, maybe the Spectres won't attack them either, like Sir Charles said.
Yeah, could be. And she wouldn't be afraid of Spectres anyway. She ain't afraid of anything. And she's so clever, Will, honest. And she's so ruthless and cruel, she could boss them, I bet she could. She could command them like she does people, and they'd have to obey her, I bet. Lord Boreal is strong and clever, but she'll have him doing what she wants in no time. Oh, Will, I'm getting scared again, thinking what she might do. I'm going to ask the alethiometer, like you said. Thank goodness we got that back anyway.
She unfolded the velvet bundle and ran her hands lovingly over the heavy gold.
I'm going to ask about your father and how we can find him. See, I put the hands to point at...
No. Ask about my mother first. I want to know if she's all right.
Lyra nodded and turned the hands before laying the alethiometer in her lap and tucking her hair behind her ears to look down and concentrate. Will watched the light needle swing purposefully round the dial, darting and stopping and darting on as swiftly as a swallow feeding, and he watched Lyra's eyes, so blue and fierce and full of clear understanding. Then she blinked and looked up.
She's safe still. This friend that's looking after her, she's ever so kind. No one knows where your mother is, and the friend won't give her away.
Will hadn't realized how worried he'd been. At this good news, he felt himself relax, and as a little tension left his body, he felt the pain of his wound more sharply.
Thank you. All right, now ask about my father.
But before she could even begin, they heard a shout from outside. They looked out at once. At the lower edge of the park in front of the first houses of the city, there was a belt of trees, and something was stirring there. Pantalaimon became a lynx at once, and padded to the open door, gazing fiercely down.
It's the children!
Both Will and Lyra stood up. The children were coming out of the trees, one by one, maybe 40 or 50 of them. Many of them were carrying sticks. At their head was the boy in the striped T-shirt, and it wasn't a stick that he was carrying. It was a pistol.
There's Angelica!
Lyra whispered, pointing. Angelica was beside the leading boy, tugging at his arm, urging him on. Just behind them, her little brother, Paolo, was shrieking with excitement, and the other children, too, were yelling and waving their fists in the air. Two of them were lugging heavy rifles. Will had seen children in this mood before, but never so many of them, and the ones in his town didn't carry guns. They were shouting, and Will managed to make out Angelica's voice, high over them all.
You killed my brother
here and you stole the knife, you murderers! You made the specters get him! You killed him and we'll kill you! You ain't gonna get away! We're gonna kill you same as you killed him!
Will, you could cut a window!
Lyra said urgently, clutching his good arm.
We could get away easy!
Yeah, and where would we be? In Oxford, a few yards from Sir Charles's house in broad daylight. Probably in the main street in front of a bus. I can't just cut through anywhere and expect to be safe. I've got to look first and see where we are, and that'd take too long. There's a forest or woods or something behind this house. If we can get up there in the trees, we'll be safer.
Lyra looked out the window, furious.
They must have seen us last night. I bet they was too cowardly to attack us on their own, so they rounded up all their mothers. I should have killed her yesterday. She's as bad as her brother. I'd like to...
Stop talking and come on.
He checked that the knife was strapped to his belt, and Lyra put on her little rucksack with the alethiometer and the letters from Will's father. They ran through the echoing hall, along the corridor and into the kitchen, through the scullery and into a cobbled court beyond it. A gate in the wall led out into a kitchen garden, where beds of vegetables and herbs lay baking under the morning sun. The edge of the woods was a few hundred yards away, up a slope of grass that was horribly exposed. On a knoll to the left, closer than the trees, stood a little building, a circular, temple-like structure with columns all the way around, and an upper story open like a balcony from which to view the city.
Let's run,
said Will, though he felt less like running than like lying down and closing his eyes. With Pantalaimon flying above to keep watch, they set off across the grass. But it was tussocky and ankle-high, and Will couldn't run more than a few steps before he felt too dizzy to carry on. He slowed to a walk. Lyra looked back. The children hadn't seen them yet. They were still at the front of the house. Maybe they'd take a while to look through all the rooms. But Pantalaimon chirruped in alarm. There was a boy standing at an open window on the second floor of the villa, pointing at them. They heard a shout.
Come on, Will!
She tugged at his good arm, helping him, lifting him. He tried to respond, but he didn't have the strength. He could only walk.
All right. We can't get to the trees, too far away. So we'll go to that temple place. If we shut the door, maybe we can hold them out for long enough to cut through after all.
Pantalaimon darted ahead, and Lyra gasped and called to him breathlessly, making him pause. Will could almost see the bond between them, the demon tugging and the girl responding. He stumbled through the thick grass with Lyra running ahead to see, and then back to help, and then ahead again, until they reached the stone pavement around the temple. The door under the little portico was unlocked, and they ran inside to find themselves in a bare, circular room with several statues of goddesses in niches around the wall. In the very center, a spiral staircase of wrought iron led up through an opening to the floor above. There was no key to lock the door, so they clambered up the staircase and onto the floorboards of an upper level that was really a viewing place, where people could come to take the air and look out over the city. For there were no windows or walls, simply a series of open arches all the way round supporting the roof. In each archway a windowsill at waist height was broad enough to lean on, and below them the pan-tiled roof ran down in a gentle slope all around to the gutter. As they looked out, they could see the forest behind, tantalizingly close, and the villa below them, and beyond that the open park, and then the red-brown roofs of the city, with the tower rising to the left. There were carrion crows wheeling in the air above the grey battlements, and Will felt a jolt of sickness as he realized what had drawn them there. But there was no time to take in the view. First they had to deal with the children, who were racing up towards the temple, screaming with rage and excitement. The leading boy slowed down and held up his pistol and fired two or three wild shots towards the temple. Then they came on again, yelling,
Thieves!
Murderers!
We're gonna kill you!
You got our knife!
You don't come from
You're gonna die!
Will took no notice. He had the knife out already, and swiftly cut a small window to see where they were, only to recoil at once. Lyra looked too, and fell back in disappointment. They were 50 feet or so in the air, high above a main road busy with traffic.
Oh, of course! We came up a slope. Well, we're stuck. We'll have to hold them off, that's all.
Another few seconds and the first children were crowding in through the door. The sound of their yelling echoed in the temple and reinforced their wildness. And then came a gunshot, enormously loud, and another, and the screaming took another tone, and then the stairs began to shake as the first ones climbed up. Lyra was crouching paralyzed against the wall, but Will still had the knife in his hand. He scrambled over to the opening in the floor and reached down and sliced through the iron of the top step as if it were paper. With nothing to hold it up, the staircase began to bend under the weight of the children crowding on it, and then it swung down and fell with a huge crash. More screams, more confusion, and again the gun went off, but this time by accident, it seemed. Someone had been hit, and the scream was of pain this time, and Will looked down to see a tangle of writhing bodies covered in plaster and dust and blood. They weren't individual children. They were a single mass, like a tide. They surged below him and leaped up in fury, snatching, threatening, screaming, spitting, but they couldn't reach. Then someone called, and they looked to the door, and those who could move surged towards it, leaving several pinned beneath the iron stairs or dazed and struggling to get up from the rubble-strewn floor. Will soon realized why they'd run out. There was a scrabbling sound from the roof outside the arches, and he ran to the windowsill to see the first pair of hands grasping the edge of the pan tiles and pulling up. Someone was pushing from behind, and then came another head and another pair of hands as they clambered over the shoulders and backs of those below and swarmed up onto the roof like ants. But the pan tile ridges were hard to walk on, and the first ones scrambled up on hands and knees, their wild eyes never leaving Will's face. Lyra had joined him, and Pantalaimon was snarling as a leopard, paws on the sill, making the first children hesitate. But still they came on, more and more of them. Someone was shouting,
"Kill! Kill! Kill!"
And then others joined in,
"Kill! Kill! 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 Kill!
Louder and louder, and those on the roof began to stamp and thump the tiles in rhythm, but they didn't quite dare come closer, faced by the snarling demon. Then a tile broke, and the boy standing on it slipped and fell, but the one beside him picked up the broken piece and hurled it at Lyra. She ducked, and it shattered on the column beside her, showering her with broken pieces. Will had noticed the rail around the edge of the opening in the floor, and cut two sword-length pieces of it, and he handed one to Lyra now. And she swung it around as hard as she could and into the side of the first boy's head. He fell at once, but then came another, and it was Angelica, red-haired, white-faced, crazy-eyed. She scrambled up onto the sill, but Lyra jabbed the length of rail at her fiercely, and she fell back again. Will was doing the same. The knife was in its sheath at his waist, and he struck and swung and jabbed with the iron rail, and while several children fell back, others kept replacing them, and more were clambering up onto the roof from below. Then the boy in the striped T-shirt appeared, but he'd lost the pistol, or perhaps it was empty. However, his eyes and Will's locked together, and each of them knew what was going to happen. They were going to fight, and it was going to be brutal and deadly.
"Come on,"
said Will, passionate for the battle.
"Come on, then."
Another second, and they would have fought. But then the strangest thing appeared. A great white snow goose swooping low, his wings spread wide, calling and calling so loudly that even the children on the roof heard through their savagery and turned to see.
"Kaiser!"
cried Lyra joyfully, for it was Seraphina Pekala's demon. The snow goose called again, a piercing whoop that filled the sky, and then wheeled and turned an inch away from the boy in the striped T-shirt. The boy fell back in fear and slid down and over the edge, and then others began to cry in alarm, too, because there was something else in the sky. As Lyra saw the little black shape sweeping out of the blue, she cheered and shouted with glee.
"Seraphina Pekala! Here! Help us! Here we are! In the temple!"
And with a hiss and rush of air, a dozen arrows, and then another dozen swiftly after, and then another dozen, loosed so quickly that they were all in the air at once, shot at the temple roof above the gallery and landed with a thunder of hammer blows. Astonished and bewildered, the children on the roof felt all the aggression leave them in a moment, and horrible fear rushed in to take its place. What were these black-garbed women rushing at them in the air? How could it happen? Were they ghosts? Were they a new kind of spectre? And whimpering and crying, they jumped off the roof, some of them falling clumsily and dragging themselves away limping, and others rolling down the slope and dashing for safety, but a mob no longer, just a lot of frightened, shame-faced children. A minute after the snow goose had appeared, the last of the children left the temple, and the only sound was the rush of air in the branches of the circling witches above. Will looked up in wonder, too amazed to speak, but Lyra was leaping and calling with delight.
"Seraphina Pekala! How did you find us? Oh, thank you, thank you! They was going to kill us! Come down and land!"
But Seraphina and the others shook their heads and flew up again, to circle high above. The snow goose demon wheeled and flew down toward the roof, beating his great wings inward to help him slow down, and landed with a clatter on the pantiles below the sill.
"Greetings, Lyra. Seraphina Pekala can't come to the ground, nor can the others. The place is full of specters, 100 or more surrounding the building, and more drifting up over the grass. Can't you see them?"
"No, we can't see them at all."
"Already we've lost one witch. We can't risk any more. Can you get down from this building?"
"If we jump off the roof like they done. But how did you find us? And where..."
"Enough now. There's more trouble coming, and bigger. Get down as best you can, and then make for the trees."
They climbed over the sill and moved sideways down through the broken tiles to the gutter. It wasn't high, and below it was grass with a gentle slope away from the building. First Lyra jumped and then Will followed, rolling over and trying to protect his hand, which was bleeding freely again and hurting badly. His sling had come loose and trailed behind him, and as he tried to roll it up, the snow goose landed on the grass at his side.
Lyra, who is this?
It's Will. He's coming with us.
Why are the specters avoiding you?
The goose demon was speaking directly to Will. By this time, Will was hardly surprised by anything, and he said,
I don't know. We can't see them. No, wait.
And he stood up, struck by a thought.
Where are they now? Where's the nearest one?
10 paces away down the slope. They don't want to come any closer, that's obvious.
Will took out the knife and looked in that direction, and he heard the demon hiss with surprise. But Will couldn't do what he intended, because at the same moment a witch landed her branch on the grass beside him. He was taken aback not so much by her flying as by her astounding gracefulness, the fierce, cold, lovely clarity of her gaze, and by the pale, bare limbs, so youthful, and yet so far from being young.
Your name is Will?
Yes, but...
Why are the specters afraid of you?
Because of the knife. Where's the nearest one? Tell me. I want to kill it.
But Lyra came running before the witch could answer.
Seraphina Pecola!
She cried, and she threw her arms around the witch and hugged her so tightly that the witch laughed out loud and kissed the top of her head.
Oh, Seraphina, where did you come from like that? We were... Those kids... They were kids, and they were going to kill us. Did you see them? We thought we were going to die, and... Oh, I'm so glad you came. I thought I'd never see you again.
Seraphina Pecola looked over Lyra's head to where the specters were obviously clustering a little way off, and then looked at Will.
Now listen. There's a cave in these woods not far away. Head up the slope and then along the ridge to the left. The specters won't follow. They don't see us while we're in the air, and they're afraid of you. We'll meet you there. It's a half hour's walk.
And she leapt into the air again. Will shaded his eyes to watch her and the other ragged, elegant figures wheel in the air and dart up over the trees.
Oh, Will, we'll be safe now. It'll be all right now that Seraphina Pecola's here. I never thought I'd see her again. She came just at the right time, didn't she? Just like before at Bolvanger.
Chattering happily, as if she'd already forgotten the fight, she led the way up the slope towards the forest. Will followed in silence. His hand was throbbing badly, and with each throb a little more blood was leaving him. He held it up across his chest and tried not to think about it. It took not half an hour, but 1 hour and 3/4, because Will had to stop and rest several times. When they reached the cave, they found a fire, a rabbit roasting, and Seraphina Pecola stirring something in a small iron pot.
"Let me see your wound,"
was the first thing she said to Will, and he dumbly held out his hand. Pantalaimon, cat-formed, watched curiously, but Will looked away. He didn't like the sight of his mutilated fingers. The witches spoke softly to each other, and then Seraphina Pecola said,
"What weapon made this wound?"
Will reached for the knife and handed it to her silently. Her companions looked at it with wonder and suspicion, for they had never seen such a blade before, with such an edge on it.
"This will need more than herbs to heal. It will need a spell." "Very well. We'll prepare one. It will be ready when the moon rises. In the meantime, you shall sleep."
She gave him a little horn cup containing a hot potion whose bitterness was moderated by honey, and presently he lay back and fell deeply asleep. The witch covered him with leaves and turned to Lyra, who was still gnawing the rabbit.
"Now, Lyra, tell me who this boy is and what you know about this world and about this knife of his."
So Lyra took a deep breath and began. Chapter 12. Screen Language.
"Tell me again,"
said Dr. Oliver Payne in the little laboratory overlooking the park.
"Either I didn't hear you, or you're talking nonsense. A child from another world?"
"That's what she said. All right, it's nonsense. But listen to it, Oliver, will you? She knew about shadows. She calls them... it. She calls it dust. But it's the same thing. It's our shadow particles. And I'm telling you, when she was wearing the electrodes linking her to the cave, there was the most extraordinary display on the screen. Pictures, symbols... She had an instrument, too, a sort of compass thing made of gold with different symbols all around the rim, and she said she could read that in the same way. And she knew about the state of mind, too. She knew it intimately.
It was mid-morning. Lyra's scholar, Dr. Malone, was red-eyed from lack of sleep, and her colleague, who'd just returned from Geneva, was impatient to hear more, and sceptical, and preoccupied.
And the point was, Oliver, she was communicating with them. They are conscious, and they can respond. And you remember your skulls? Well, she told me about some skulls in the Pitt Rivers Museum. She'd found out with her compass thing that they were much older than the museum said. And there were shadows.
Wait a minute. Give me some sort of structure here. What are you saying? You saying she's confirmed what we know already, or that she's telling us something new?
Both. I don't know. But suppose something happened 30,000, 40,000 years ago. There were shadow particles around before then, obviously. I mean, they've been around since the Big Bang, but there was no physical way of amplifying their effects at our level, the anthropic level, the level of human beings. And then something happened. I can't imagine what, but it involved evolution. Hence, your skulls, remember? No shadows before that time, lots afterwards. And the skulls the child found in the museum, that she tested with her compass thing, she told me the same thing. What I'm saying is that around that time, the human brain became the ideal vehicle for this amplification process. Suddenly, we became conscious.
Dr. Payne tilted his plastic mug and drank the last of his coffee.
Why should it happen particularly at that time? Why suddenly 35,000 years ago?
Oh, who can say? We're not paleontologists. I don't know, Oliver. I'm just speculating. Don't you think it's at least possible?
And this policeman, tell me about him.
Dr. Malone rubbed her eyes.
Oh, his name is Walters. He said he was from the special branch. I thought that was politics or something.
Terrorism, subversion, intelligence, all that. Go on. What did he want? Why did he come here?
Because of the girl. He said he was looking for a boy of about the same age. He didn't tell me why. And this boy had been seen in the company of the girl who came here. But he had something else in mind as well, Oliver. He knew about the research. He even asked...
The telephone rang. She broke off, shrugging, and Dr. Payne answered it. He spoke briefly, put it down, and said...
We've got a visitor.
Who?
Not a name I know. Sir somebody, something. Listen, Mary, I'm off. You realize that, don't you?
They offered you the job?
Yes. I've got to take it. You must see that.
Well, that's the end of this, then.
He spread his hands helplessly and said...
To be frank, I can't see any point in the sort of stuff you've just been talking about. Children from another world and fossil shadows. It's all too crazy. I just can't get involved. I've got a career, Mary.
What about the skulls you tested? What about the shadows around the ivory figurine?
He shook his head and turned his back. Before he could answer, there came a tap at the door, and he opened it almost with relief. Sir Charles said,
Good day to you. Dr. Payne? Dr. Malone? My name's Charles Latram. It's very good of you to see me without any notice.
Come in,
said Dr. Malone, weary but puzzled.
Did Oliver say, Sir Charles? What can we do for you?
It may be what I can do for you. I understand you're waiting for the results of your funding application.
How do you know that?
I used to be a civil servant. As a matter of fact, I was concerned with directing scientific policy. I still have a number of contacts in the field, and I heard... May I sit down?
Oh, please.
She pulled out a chair, and he sat down as if he were in charge of a meeting.
Thank you. I heard through a friend. I'd better not mention his name. The Official Secrets Act covers all sorts of silly things. I heard that your application was being considered, and what I heard about it intrigued me so much that I must confess I asked to see some of your work. Well, I know I had no business to, except that I still act as a sort of unofficial advisor, so I used that as an excuse. And really, what I saw was quite fascinating.
Does that mean you think we'll be successful?
Said Dr. Malone, leaning forward, eager to believe him.
Unfortunately, no. I must be blunt. They're not minded to renew your grant.
Dr. Malone's shoulders slumped. Dr. Payne was watching the old man with cautious curiosity.
Why have you come here now, then?
Well, you see, they haven't officially made the decision yet. It doesn't look promising, and I'm being frank with you. They see no prospect of funding work of this sort in the future. However, it might be that if you had someone to argue the case for you, they would see it differently.
An advocate? You mean yourself? I didn't think it worked like that,
said Dr. Malone, sitting up.
I thought they went on peer review and so on.
It does in principle, of course, but it also helps to know how these committees work in practice, and to know who is on them. Well, here I am. I'm intensely interested in your work. I think it might be very valuable, and it certainly ought to continue. Would you let me make informal representations on your behalf?
Dr. Malone felt like a drowning sailor being thrown a lifebelt.
Why, well, yes. Good grief, of course. And thank you. I mean, do you really think it'll make a difference? I don't mean to suggest that... I don't know what I mean. Yes, of course.
What would we have to do?
Dr. Malone looked at him in surprise. Hadn't Oliver just said he was going to work in Geneva? But he seemed to be understanding Sir Charles better than she was, for a flicker of complicity was passing between them, and Oliver came to sit down, too.
I'm glad you take my point. You're quite right. There is a direction I'd be especially glad to see you taking. And, provided we could agree, I might even be able to find you some extra money from another source altogether.
Wait, wait. Wait a minute. The course of this research is a matter for us. I'm perfectly willing to discuss the results, but not the direction. Well, surely you see.
Sir Charles spread his hands in a gesture of regret and got to his feet. Oliver Payne stood too, anxious.
No, please, Sir Charles. I'm sure Dr. Malone will hear you out. Mary, there's no harm in listening, for goodness sake, and it might make all the difference.
I thought you were going to Geneva.
Geneva? Excellent place. Lot of scope there. Lot of money, too. Don't let me hold you back.
No, no, it's not settled yet. There's a lot to discuss. It's all still very fluid. Sir Charles, please, sit down. Can I get you some coffee?
That would be very kind,
said Sir Charles, and sat again with the air of a satisfied cat. Dr. Malone looked at him clearly for the first time. She saw a man in his late 60s, prosperous, confident, beautifully dressed, used to the very best of everything, used to moving among powerful people and whispering in important ears. Oliver was right. He did want something. And they wouldn't get his support unless they satisfied him. She folded her arms. Dr. Payne handed him a mug, saying,
Sorry, it's rather primitive.
Not at all. Shall I go on with what I was saying?
Do, please.
Well, I understand that you've made some fascinating discoveries in the field of consciousness. Yes, I know you haven't published anything yet, and it's a long way, seemingly, from the apparent subject of your research. Nevertheless, word gets around. And I'm especially interested in that. I would be very pleased if, for example, you were to concentrate your research on the manipulation of consciousness. Second, the many worlds hypothesis. Everett, you remember? 1957 or thereabouts? I believe you're on the track of something that could take that theory a good deal further. And that line of research might even attract defense funding, which, as you may know, is still plentiful even today, and certainly isn't subject to these wearisome application processes. Don't expect me to reveal my sources,
he went on, holding up his hand as Dr. Malone sat forward and tried to speak.
I mentioned the Official Secrets Act. A tedious piece of legislation, but we mustn't be naughty about it. I confidently expect some advances in the many worlds area. I think you are the people to do it. And third, there is a particular matter connected with an individual, a child.
He paused there and sipped the coffee. Dr. Malone couldn't speak. She'd gone pale, though she couldn't know that, but she did know that she felt faint.
For various reasons, I am in contact with the intelligence services. They are interested in a child, a girl, who has an unusual piece of equipment, an antique scientific instrument, certainly stolen, which should be in safer hands than hers. There's also a boy of roughly the same age, 12 or so, who is wanted in connection with a murder. It's a moot point whether a child of that age is capable of murder, of course, but he has certainly killed someone. And he has been seen with the girl. Now, Dr. Malone, it may be that you have come across one or the other of these children, and it may be that you're quite properly inclined to tell the police about what you know, but you would be doing a greater service if you were to let me know privately. I can make sure the proper authorities deal with it efficiently and quickly, and with no stupid tabloid publicity. I know that Inspector Walters came to see you yesterday, and I know that the girl turned up. You see, I do know what I'm talking about. I would know, for instance, if you saw her again. And if you didn't tell me, I would know that, too. You'd be very wise to think hard about that and to clarify your recollections of what she said and did when she was here. This is a matter of national security, you understand me? Well, there, I'll stop. Here's my card, so you can get in touch. I shouldn't leave it too long. The funding committee meets tomorrow, as you know. But you can reach me at this number at any time.
He gave a card to Oliver Payne, and seeing Dr. Malone with her arms still folded, laid one on the bench for her. Dr. Payne held the door for him. Sir Charles set his Panama hat on his head, patted it gently, beamed at both of them, and left. When he shut the door again, Dr. Payne said,
"Mary, are you mad? Where's the sense in behaving like that?"
"I beg your pardon. You're not taken in by that old creep, are you?"
"You can't turn down offers like that. Do you want this project to survive or not?"
"It wasn't an offer. It was an ultimatum. Do as he says or close down. And, Oliver, for God's sake, all those not-so-subtle threats and hints about national security and so on, can't you see where that would lead?"
"Well, I think I can see it more clearly than you can. If you said no, they wouldn't close this place down. They'd take it over. If they're as interested as he says, they'll want it to carry on, but only on their terms."
"But their terms would be, I mean, defense, for God's sake. They want to find new ways of killing people. And you heard what he said about consciousness. He wants to manipulate it. I'm not going to get mixed up in that, Oliver. Never."
"They'll do it anyway, and you'll be out of a job. If you stay, you might be able to influence it in a better direction. And you'd still have your hands on the work. You'd still be involved."
"But what does it matter to you anyway? I thought Geneva was all settled."
He ran his hands through his hair and said,
"Well, not settled, nothing signed. And it would be a different angle altogether. And I'd be sorry to leave here now that I think we're really on to something."
"What are you saying?"
"I'm not saying..."
"You're hinting. What are you getting at?"
"Well..."
He walked around the laboratory, spreading his hands, shrugging, shaking his head.
"Well, if you don't get in touch with them, I will."
"Oh, I see."
"Mary, I've got to think of my..."
"Of course you have."
"It's not that
no,
I want..."
"No,
no." "You don't understand..."
"Yes,
how...
I do. It's very simple. You promise to do as he says. You get the funding. I leave. You take over as director. It's not hard to understand. You'd have a bigger budget, lots of nice new machines, half a dozen more PhDs under you. Good idea. You do it, Oliver. You go ahead. But that's it for me. I'm off. It stinks."
"You haven't..."
But her expression silenced him. She took off her white coat and hung it on the door, gathered a few papers into a bag, and left without a word. As soon as she'd gone, he took Sir Charles's card and picked up the phone. Several hours later, just before midnight, in fact, Dr. Malone parked her car outside the science building and let herself in at the side entrance. But just as she turned to climb the stairs, a man came out of another corridor, startling her so much she nearly dropped her briefcase. He was wearing a uniform.
"Where are you going?"
He stood in the way, bulky, his eyes hardly visible under the low brim of his cap.
I'm going to my laboratory. I work here. Who are you?"
she said, a little angry, a little frightened.
"Security. Have you got some ID?"
"What security? I left this building at 3 o'clock this afternoon and there was only a porter on duty, as usual. I should be asking you for identification. Who appointed you, and why?"
"Here's my ID,"
said the man, showing her a card too quickly for her to read it.
"Where's yours?"
She noticed he had a mobile phone in a holster at his hip. Or was it a gun? No, surely she was being paranoid. And he hadn't answered her questions. But if she persisted, she'd make him suspicious, and the important thing now was to get into the lab. Soothe him like a dog, she thought. She fumbled through her bag and found her wallet.
"Will this do?"
she said, showing him the card she used to operate the barrier in the car park. He looked at it briefly.
"What are you doing here at this time of night?"
"I've got an experiment running. I have to check the computer periodically."
He seemed to be searching for a reason to forbid her, or perhaps he was just exercising his power. Finally he nodded and stood aside. She went past, smiling at him, but his face remained blank. When she reached the laboratory, she was still trembling. There had never been any more security in this building than a lock on the door and an elderly porter, and she knew why the change had come about. But it meant that she had very little time. She'd have to get it right at once, because once they realized what she was doing, she wouldn't be able to come back again. She locked the door behind her and lowered the blinds. She switched on the detector and then took a floppy disk from her pocket and slipped it into the computer that controlled the cave. Within a minute she had begun to manipulate the numbers on the screen, going half by logic, half by guesswork, and half by the program she'd worked on all evening at home, and the complexity of her task was about as baffling as getting three halves to make one whole. Finally she brushed the hair out of her eyes and put the electrodes on her head, and then flexed her fingers and began to type. She felt intensely self-conscious.
Hello. I'm not sure what I'm doing. Maybe this is crazy.
The words arranged themselves on the left of the screen, which was the first surprise. She wasn't using a word processing program of any kind. In fact, she was bypassing much of the operating system. And whatever formatting was imposing itself on the words, it wasn't hers. She felt the hairs begin to stir on the back of her neck, and she became aware of the whole building around her. The corridors dark, the machines idling, various experiments running automatically, computers monitoring tests and recording the results, the air conditioning sampling and adjusting the humidity and the temperature, all the ducts and pipework and cabling that were the arteries and the nerves of the building, awake and alert, almost conscious, in fact. She tried again.
I'm trying to do with words what I've done before with a state of mind, but...
Before she had even finished the sentence, the cursor raced across to the right of the screen and printed,
"Ask a question."
It was almost instantaneous. She felt as if she'd stepped on a space that wasn't there. Her whole being lurched with shock. It took several moments for her to calm down enough to try again. When she did, the answers lashed themselves across the right of the screen almost before she'd finished.
Are you shadows?
Yes.
Are you the same as Lyra's dust?
Yes.
And is that dark matter?
Yes.
Dark matter is conscious?
Evidently.
What I said to Oliver this morning, my idea about human evolution, is it...
Correct, but you need to ask more questions.
She stopped, took a deep breath, pushed her chair back, flexed her fingers. She could feel her heart racing. Every single thing about what was happening was impossible. All her education, all her habits of mind, all her sense of herself as a scientist was shrieking at her silently, "This is wrong. It isn't happening. You're dreaming." And yet there they were on the screen, her questions and answers from some other mind. She gathered herself and typed again, and again the answers zipped into being with no discernible pause.
The mind that is answering these questions isn't human, is it?
No, but humans have always known us.
Us? There's more than one of you.
Uncountable billions.
But what are you?
Angels.
Mary Malone's head rang. She'd been brought up as a Catholic. More than that, as Lyra had discovered, she had once been a nun. None of her faith was left to her now, but she knew about angels. St. Augustine had said, "Angel is the name of their office, not of their nature. If you seek the name of their nature, it is spirit. If you seek the name of their office, it is angel. From what they are, spirit. From what they do, angel." Dizzy, trembling, she typed again.
"Angels are creatures of shadow matter, of dust."
"Structures, complexifications, yes."
"And shadow matter is what we have called spirit?"
"From what we are, spirit. From what we do, matter. Matter and spirit are one."
She shivered. They'd been listening to her thoughts.
"And did you intervene in human evolution?"
"Yes."
"Why?"
"Vengeance."
"Vengeance for... Oh, rebel angels! After the war in heaven, Satan and the Garden of Eden... But it isn't true, is it? Is that what you..."
"Find the girl and the boy. Waste no more time."
"But why?"
"You must play the serpent."
She took her hands from the keyboard and rubbed her eyes. The words were still there when she looked again.
"Where?"
"Go to a road called Sunderland Avenue and find a tent. Deceive the guardian and go through. Take provisions for a long journey. You will be protected. The spectres will not touch you."
"But I..."
"Before you go, destroy this equipment."
"I don't understand. Why me? And what's this journey? And..."
"You have been preparing for this as long as you have lived. Your work here is finished. The last thing you must do in this world is prevent the enemies from taking control of it. Destroy the equipment. Do it now and go at once."
Mary Malone pushed back the chair and stood up, trembling. She pressed her fingers to her temples and discovered the electrodes still attached to her skin. She took them off absently. She might have doubted what she had done and what she could still see on the screen, but she had passed in the last half hour or so beyond doubt and belief altogether. Something had happened, and she was galvanized. She switched off the detector and the amplifier. Then she bypassed all the safety codes and formatted the computer's hard disk, wiping it clean. And then she removed the interface between the detector and the amplifier, which was on a specially adapted card, and put the card on the bench and smashed it with the heel of her shoe, there being nothing else heavy at hand. Next, she disconnected the wiring between the electromagnetic shield and the detector, and found the wiring plan in a drawer of the filing cabinet and set light to it. Was there anything else she could do? She couldn't do much about Oliver Payne's knowledge of the program, but the special hardware was effectively demolished. She crammed some papers from a drawer into her briefcase, and finally took down the poster with the I Ching hexagrams and folded it away in her pocket. Then she switched off the light and left. The security guard was standing at the foot of the stairs, speaking into his telephone. He put it away as she came down, and escorted her silently to the side entrance, watching through the glass door as she drove away. An hour and a half later, she parked her car in a road near Sunderland Avenue. She had had to find it on a map of Oxford. She didn't know this part of town. Up till this moment, she had been moving on pent-up excitement, but as she got out of her car in the dark of the small hours and found the night cool and silent and still all around her, she felt a definite lurch of apprehension. Suppose she was dreaming. Suppose it was all some elaborate joke. Well, it was too late to worry about that. She was committed. She lifted out the rucksack she'd often taken on camping journeys in Scotland and the Alps, and reflected that at least she knew how to survive out of doors. If worst came to worst, she could always run away, take to the hills. Ridiculous. But she swung the rucksack onto her back, left the car, turned into the Banbury Road, and walked the 200 or 300 yards up to where Sunderland Avenue ran left from the traffic circle. She felt almost more foolish than she had ever felt in her life. But as she turned the corner and saw those strange, childlike trees that Will had seen, she knew that something at least was true about all this. Under the trees on the grass at the far side of the road, there was a small square tent of red and white nylon, the sort that electricians put up to keep the rain off while they work, and parked close by was an unmarked white transit van with darkened glass in the windows. Better not hesitate. She walked straight across towards the tent. When she was nearly there, the back door of the van swung open and a policeman stepped out. Without his helmet he looked very young, and the streetlight under the dense green of the leaves above shone full on his face.
"Could I ask where you're going, madam?"
Into that tent.
"I'm afraid you can't, madam. I've got orders not to let anyone near it."
"Good. I'm glad they've got the place protected. But I'm from the Department of Physical Sciences. Sir Charles Latram asked us to make a preliminary survey and then report back before they look at it properly. It's important that it's done now while there aren't many people around. I'm sure you understand the reasons for that."
"Well, yes, but have you got anything to show who you are?"
"Oh, sure,"
she said, and swung the rucksack off her back to get at her purse. Among the items she'd taken from the drawer in the laboratory was an expired library card of Oliver Payne's. 15 minutes' work at her kitchen table, and the photograph from her own passport, had produced something she hoped would pass for genuine. The policeman took the laminated card and looked at it closely.
"Dr. Olive Payne. Do you happen to know a Dr. Mary Malone?"
"Oh, yes. She's a colleague."
"Do you know where she is now?"
"At home in bed, if she's got any sense. Why?"
"Well, I understand her position in your organization's been terminated, and she wouldn't be allowed through here. In fact, we've got orders to detain her if she tries. And seeing a woman, I naturally thought you might be her, if you see what I mean. Excuse me, Dr. Payne."
"Ah, I see,"
said Mary Malone. The policeman looked at the card once more.
"Still, this seems all right,"
he said, and handed it back. Nervous, wanting to talk, he went on.
"Do you know what's in there under that tent?"
"Well, not first-hand. That's why I'm here now."
"Oh, I suppose it is. All right then, Dr. Payne."
He stood back and let her unlace the flap of the tent. She hoped he wouldn't see the shaking of her hands. Clutching the rucksack to her breast, she stepped through. Deceive the guardian. Well, she'd done that. But she had no idea what she would find inside the tent. She was prepared for some sort of archaeological dig, for a dead body, for a meteorite. But nothing in her life or her dreams had prepared her for that square yard or so in midair, or for the silent, sleeping city by the sea that she found when she stepped through it. Chapter 13. Asa Heather. As the moon rose, the witches began their spell to heal Will's wound. They woke him and asked him to lay the knife on the ground, where it caught a glitter of starlight. Lyra sat nearby, stirring some herbs in a pot of boiling water over a fire, and while her companions clapped and stamped and cried in rhythm, Seraphina crouched over the knife and sang in a high, fierce tone,
"Little knife, they tore your iron out of Mother Earth's entrails, built a fire and boiled the ore, made it weep and bleed and flood, hammered it and tempered it, plunging it in icy water, heating it inside the forge, till your blade was blood-red, scorching. Then they made you wound the water once again and yet again, till the steam was boiling fog, and the water cried for mercy. And when you sliced a single shade into 30,000 shadows, then they knew that you were ready. Then they called you Subtle One. But Little Knife, what have you done? Unlocked blood gates left them wide. Little Knife, your mother calls you from the entrails of the earth, from her deepest mines and caverns, from her secret iron womb. Listen.
And Seraphina stamped again and clapped her hands with the other witches, and they shook their throats to make a wild ululation that tore at the air like claws. Will, seated in the middle of them, felt a chill at the core of his spine. Then Seraphina Pekala turned to Will himself and took his wounded hand in both of hers. When she sang this time, he nearly flinched, so fierce was her high, clear voice, so glittering her eyes. But he sat without moving and let the spell go on.
Blood, obey me. Turn around. Be a lake and not a river. When you reach the open air, stop and build a clotted wall. Build it firm to hold the flood back. Blood, your sky is the skull dome. Your sun is the open eye. Your wind, the breath inside the lungs. Blood, your world is bounded. Stay there.
Will thought he could feel all the atoms of his body responding to her command, and he joined in, urging his leaking blood to listen and obey. She put his hand down and turned to the little iron pot over the fire. A bitter steam was rising from it, and Will heard the liquid bubbling fiercely. Seraphina sang,
"Oak bark, spider silk, ground moss, saltweed, grip close, bind tight. Hold fast, close up, bar the door, lock the gate, stiffen the blood wall, dry the gore flood."
Then the witch took her own knife and split an alder sapling along its whole length. The wounded whiteness gleamed open in the moon. She daubed some of the steaming liquid into the split, then closed up the wood, easing it together from the root to the tip. And the sapling was whole again. Will heard Lyra gasp, and turned to see another witch holding a squirming, struggling hare in her tough hands. The animal was panting, wild-eyed, kicking furiously, but the witch's hands were merciless. In one she held its forelegs, and with the other she grasped its hind legs and pulled the frenzied hare out straight, its heaving belly upward. Seraphina's knife swept across it. Will felt himself grow dizzy, and Lyra was restraining Pantalaimon. Hare formed himself in sympathy, who was bucking and snapping in her arms. The real hare fell still, eyes bulging, breast heaving, entrails glistening. But Seraphina took some more of the decoction and trickled it into the gaping wound, and then closed up the wound with her fingers, smoothing the wet fur over it until there was no wound at all. The witch holding the animal relaxed her grip and let it gently to the ground, where it shook itself, turned to lick its flank, flicked its ears, and nibbled a blade of grass as if it were completely alone. Suddenly it seemed to become aware of the circle of witches around it, and like an arrow it shot away, whole again, bounding swiftly off into the dark. Lyra, soothing Pantalaimon, glanced at Will and saw that he knew what it meant. The medicine was ready. He held out his hand, and as Seraphina daubed the steamy mixture on the bleeding stumps of his fingers, he looked away and breathed in sharply several times, but he didn't flinch. Once his open flesh was thoroughly soaked, the witch pressed some of the sodden herbs onto the wounds and tied them tight around with a strip of silk. And that was it. The spell was done. Will slept deeply through the rest of the night. It was cold, but the witches piled leaves over him, and Lyra slept huddled close behind his back. In the morning, Seraphina dressed his wound again, and he tried to see from her expression whether it was healing, but her face was calm and impassive. Once they'd eaten, Seraphina told the children that the witches had agreed that since they'd come into this world to find Lyra and be her guardians, they'd help Lyra do what she now knew her task to be, namely to guide Will to his father. So they all set off, and it was quiet going for the most part. Lyra consulted